First of all, I'd like to thank the Mackinac Center for giving me this opportunity to talk about smart growth, land use planning, and statewide growth management. This is an issue which I've become very interested in over the last decade, and my own background is in regional and urban economics, and I've been doing that as sort of consultant, policy analyst, academic over in various capacities over the last several years. And really over the last decade is when I've become more and more interested in the issues of land use planning and then how that translates into statewide growth management on another plane, which is really something, while we've had statewide growth management around for several decades, it's really taken off in terms of popularity within the last decade and with a couple of very bold experiments. And so what I would like, I appreciate this opportunity to talk about these issues. I think I'm going to bring a different perspective, and from what I could tell of the folks that have RSVP'd for this, this is a very diverse group, which means there's a good chance that everyone will be angry at me by the time we leave. It's just a question of in what dimension you're angry. So what I plan to do is spend about 25 minutes going through my presentation. Really, I want to do three things. One is I want to provide an overview, at least from my perspective, of what some of the major statewide growth management programs what are out there and sort of gives us a little dimension, a little context. Then I want to give a little bit of information that is part data, part my take on what the effectiveness of some of these programs have been. And to some extent, I'm going to be concentrating on the pitfalls. In other words, some of the warts in the process. A lot of this, by the way, is going to be very implementation driven. And because one of the things that I've been very concerned about in my professional work as well as in my work as a policy analyst is not so much what we want to have happen, but what actually happens when we actually put put the rubber to the road and try and get things done. And then third, I think out of that it'll become pretty clear that I'm a pretty big skeptic about how our conventional approaches to growth management will work, particularly on the state level. But I'd like to give you a couple of ideas about how I think we should be thinking differently about how we approach this on the state level. And so my approach, even though I think I am a market-oriented person, I mean, that's my approach to looking at issues. It comes from one where I try to focus on looking at people as consumers. You know, where do they want to live? I look at urban development and cities from the context of the healthiest neighborhoods, the healthiest cities are the ones where people want to live there and stay, as opposed to sort of maybe some more abstract level. But I think what I've come to recognize is that in the area of growth management, and particularly in the area of statewide growth management, we need to recognize that there are other issues in play that really can muck up the system if we're not aware of it. And at least I hope to get some of those on the table. At least as part of discussion. And I'm looking forward to the Q&A, although I realize that it may be rather, I didn't bring my bulletproof vest, but who knows what'll happen. First of all, just to start off, what I like to do is sort of ground myself in terms of these presentations, but also to provide an overview. I think it's important to understand what drives growth management. And as part of this, I'll also acknowledge, although I'm acknowledged as a critic of a lot of what we do in growth management, that doesn't mean that I don't recognize that there are serious issues that we need to grapple with very often through the public sector and through governance. And that these issues are the reason why we're here today. And so we've got to grapple with them. It's a question of how we grapple with them. First of all, one of the things I continually see, and this is true on the local, regional, and state level, is one of the things that we're trying to do with growth management is figure out a way that we can more actively shape the community that we exist in or we think might emerge. Now, part of this, what we're seeing are, this is where issues like compatible growth, in other words, if you're going to have investment in my neighborhood, it ought to be consistent with my neighborhood. So it's, we're not going to create a steel foundry next to a single-family residential housing. There's also very often a lot of discussion about a community vision. And this it's interesting for me, a lot of that kind of discussion occurs at the same level of analysis, whether you're at the state or the regional or the local level. So we end up going through the same process in my community, where I serve on my local planning board, but I chair my local planning board. in terms of thinking about vision, how does that relate to the comprehensive plan? That's a lot of what you struggle with, even at a more general level of government, like either a regional government or even at the state level. And then finally, what I think is interesting, a part of this, is that there's clearly an interest by some to stop what they call sprawl. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. Another key goal is to promote efficient growth. Now, this is what this means also can vary quite a bit. But I think in many cases, we're concerned about linking service demand with service provision. In other words, if we're going to be providing water, we need to somehow link the people that are going to be using that service to the actual cost of providing it, preserving open space, also stopping sprawl. I mean, that's sort of that continues to be an emerging theme. And all of these efforts at growth management is to focus on that. And then finally, there's this issue of sustainability, which frankly, after having gone through a lot of the literature and looking at how this is used, I still don't know what this is. It's a term. It sort of carries a lot of currency. It's certainly on an intuitive level. It seems, yeah, we want to make sure that our community will be just as vibrant in 20 years as it is now. But in terms of what it means in a concrete way, I don't see a lot of content in it. And, you know, frankly, that may be because I'm coming from partly an academic perspective where I've been immersed in issues like neighborhood revitalization, urban revitalization for two decades, and I just can't find any theme in the academic literature where people have been quantitatively trying to figure out how do you create a sustainable neighborhood, how do you revitalize a neighborhood. There just isn't the kind of consensus that at least allows me to analytically look at sustainability as something that I can actually develop public policy around very effectively. But anyway, with those kinds of issues framing the debate, what are some of the examples we can look to? And actually, they're unlike where I think we were a decade ago, where we may have had maybe three or four states where we could look to as sort of cutting-edge experimenters. We've got more models, if you will, now. And I'm just going to focus on three of them to give us a sense of some of the dimension. I think on one hand, you've got Oregon, which gets a lot of press. It is a system in which planning, regional planning, is mandatory. It has it has state goals and objectives. And if I remember right, I think there are over 20 state goals and objectives that have to be addressed through planning in Oregon. It is also very much process-based. In other words, they're very concerned about making sure the process in which changes to plans are made is adhered to. It is also a regional system. There's a big focus on regional planning. This is why urban growth boundaries are a very important feature of that. Urban growth boundaries literally aligned in the land beyond which you're not supposed to promote growth and development. And this is different from an urban service boundary. An urban service boundary is where you have a line, but that beyond that line you don't extend publicly funded utilities. An urban growth boundary says you're not going to develop anything beyond that. So in principle, if you have an urban service boundary, you just say, okay, it's not cost effective for us to extend water and sewer out into the rural area. But if you're on a 10 or 20 acre, you know, septic system may work fine and well, so you can still allow that kind of development. An urban growth boundary basically says you can't do that. And the strictest ones, I think, are in Oregon, where they are trying to preserve open space, and it's an explicit goal of the program, and they do it through regulation. Urban growth boundary is a regulation, and it's mandatory. It's very difficult to change those boundaries as well. Also, there's an emphasis on environmental planning, as you might expect, in some place like Oregon. Another model that we can talk about is Florida, which I think is interesting because it operates in terms of the implementation in a very different way than other states do. And also, unlike Oregon implemented the concern about sprawl and loss of farmland was an important driver of the Oregon planning. But in Florida, what really triggered a lot of the planning politically was rapid growth. I mean, they were having houses going up. Services were not keeping up with it. And unlike Oregon, which really wasn't growth per se, it was more of concern about what's happening to sort of the environment in general and concern about sprawl, Florida was concerned about a lot of people coming to the state in a very short period of time and whether or not they were simply capable of handling it from the point of view of public infrastructure. And that has an effect on the structure of the plan. This is also a mandatory system. Essentially, what Florida said is that cities need to, and counties, need to come up with a comprehensive plan. There are goals. There aren't as many as in Oregon. I think there are maybe 16 over a dozen, I think. But that you have to come up with a comprehensive plan. Then the state actually has to certify that that plan that you have adopted is consistent with the state goals. And so the administration of this program has been a fundamental responsibility of the state, and it's very top-down. So you have this consistency, which means that the local plans have to actually address in a substantive way, the goals laid out in the state plans, and then you have to have consistency between state, regional, and local plans, so it sort of builds on each other, which, by the way, makes sense from an analytical perspective, but it creates issues, I guess, from an implementation perspective. State approval of local plans based on reducing sprawl, that has actually been a criteria. In other words, you need to get higher density, more mixed use. You have to limit the development of farmland, and all of that is being part of sprawl. And actually, the definition of sprawl has been an important defining point, I think, of Florida's growth management system. Concurrency has also... Florida brought the term concurrency into this debate. And what concurrency means simply is making sure your investment in infrastructure corresponds with the growth that you actually have. So you don't end up having hundreds of houses that are being constructed without any water or sewer or roads. So it should be in place to support development and also environmental sensitivity. You can think about the problems you have with the Everglades. For example, a lot of development, they were also concerned about what was happening to orange groves. So this is another model. And these are some of the issues that have come up. And I think in Michigan, we're hearing a lot about issues like concurrency. And that is, I think, derived from Florida. The other model, which I'd like to talk about very briefly, is Maryland. Maryland is different because both Florida and Oregon are mandatory, but Maryland is a voluntary system. In the broad sense that what they're trying to do is focus on incentives. There are two aspects to it. They want the locals to come along with them, sort of to the party, if you will. But they're doing it primarily by trying to give them incentives to actually conform to the goals. And not only that, they're trying to redirect state policy. In other words, they're not really trying to at least officially tell cities and counties what to do, but make the incentives strong enough that they'll actually do it. Some of the key aspects of the Maryland program are things called priority funding areas. It's a variation of the urban service boundary and the urban growth boundary. What they're trying to do is prevent development out in rural areas, but what they're doing is they're saying we're not going to let the infrastructure outside of what are called these priority funding areas, which are essentially urban service areas. Now, the local government can still extend infrastructure, but it's going to be on the local tap to do it. At least in principle, that's the way it was set up. Also have what they call a rural legacy program, where they're just trying to buy development rights to rural land to make sure that it won't be developed and use other kinds of zoning regulations to preserve open space. They have an interesting program called Live Where You Work, where they actually give you financial incentives, not based on income, based on where you live, that if you live closer to where you work, you actually get a financial incentive to do that. And it's to try and promote people living in urban areas and to use, preferably to use mass transit rather than automobiles. Brownfield redevelopment has been a huge, an important part of this, actually, and means redeveloping inner city sites. And job creation tax credits in urban areas has also been an important part of this. So these are essentially three broad frameworks that I think you get in terms of how statewide growth management has been implemented that are important to keep in mind. We also have a lot of local government growth management experiments. This includes in part in Michigan, which I think public sector consultants has identified some areas where some regions in Michigan have been tried to plan and been successful. But also places like California doesn't have a statewide growth management plan in place, but you find certain areas which have been very, very aggressive in growth management, adopting very very strong growth controls on the local level. In Ventura County, for example, which is outside of Los Angeles, it's a county of about 700,000 people, they have urban growth boundaries. They require citizen approval for expanding, for changing in zoning. They have a supposedly streamlined process for increasing mixed use. Pennsylvania, Lancaster County has put a lot of effort into preserving open space as well. So it's not just the statewide growth management. We also have to look at what's going on at the local level. All right, well, those are some of the models that we can talk about. But that's kind of interesting, I think, in the sense that we're seeing more and more variation. But what intrigues me about this is sort of what really happens when the rubber meets the road and you're trying to implement this. So about 5 years ago, when I was working for Reason Foundation in Los Angeles, we identified statewide growth management as an area we wanted to do some investigation and just sort of try and look at, evaluate what some of these impacts are. And I was really struck by how little information was out there on these. In fact, the best analysis that we found on growth management in this broader context, outside of some more limited economic studies which have looked at, for example, the effects of growth controls on housing prices. Actually, that has been, there's a lot of literature out there on that. But we, in terms of this new wave of growth management that we see emerge in the 90s and in the 80s, there's very little on that. And so we actually identified that as a potential, as an area we could actually provide, do some research. And but we were struck by how little was out there. And so we took out, sort of bit off a little bit of the pie. We started looking at housing affordability in particular and started doing some analysis. And but I think what even struck me more about how little information there was about it, some of the planning profession had sort of looked at in Florida what had happened when we implemented the statewide growth management law. Did in fact we get more comprehensive plans and were they updated? Well, in fact they were. So you actually got the planning profession to move. But almost no analysis that tied the growth management law implementation to the actual goals and outcomes that were intended. And so we bought off, we sort of bought off a little part of the housing affordability part of it. Actually, I'll leave that up there. And so we said, okay, well, let's, one of the biggest issues that we run into is housing affordability. So let's see if we can figure out, and using a time series, which means we're looking over a decade if we can get that, what happened to housing prices and if we can identify if there's been any impact on housing price increase from the statewide growth management laws. And we decided, okay, we'll take Oregon because it's been around since the 70s. We will take Florida because the Florida growth management law was in the 1980s. And then we'll take Washington State because it was implemented in 1990 and see what we can come up with. Oregon's been around the longest. We could find virtually no reliable data that was even being collected to assess whether these programs were effective or not on the state level. We found some local stuff. In fact, again, Portland, Oregon has been studied pretty extensively, and there's a book put out by the Urban Land Institute on Oregon's growth management laws, but there is a stunning lack of information. So actually what we found as we got into this is we could actually provide some value added by providing some analysis. But also, I think for me, from a process, and this is important for Michigan and Ohio, where I'm from, we're going to be addressing this thing, these issues in the same way that you are. It's very important to think in terms of how you're going to evaluate the success of whatever you put into place. Because the problem is, you've got a lot of people that can be very critical or supportive of one of these laws, but there isn't any real data analysis to decide, to know really what the effects are. So anyway, we were unable to find the information we needed in Oregon. State didn't collect it, or at least if they did, they weren't telling us and they weren't letting it publicly known. But we were able to get data on Florida and Washington State. And again, we were focused on housing affordability. I'm just using this as an example. And what we were able to do is control for things like density, household size, because if you have more households, you need more housing to accommodate those people. And household size are getting smaller. Household income and geography, because that's very important. In Washington State, for example, if you're in the Seattle metropolitan area, that has a huge impact on the dynamics of the local housing market. And in Florida, you find the same thing if you're in Orlando versus Miami, that type of thing. And essentially what we were we found in our empirical analysis was that housing price, about a quarter of the housing price increase in those states, in those metropolitan areas and in other areas, could be attributed to the growth management program, implementation of the growth management program. Now, we measured that by looking at when these cities and counties came into compliance with a state growth management law and looked at housing prices before and after. Essentially, went and see if we can come up with a statistical examination of that. And we found, now, be careful about how far we take this. What we did is we found an effect. It's, we can argue over the magnitude, this is actually not that inconsistent with a lot of other observers who've looked at this. It doesn't tell us much about why, though. And the why is what's going to be important. It's going to be an important part of what I want to talk about here. But before I get to that, I want to talk about Ventura County, which is a local, so we're dealing in Michigan with statewide. But this is, I think Ventura County is interesting because it tells us a little insight into the politics behind this, which also I think ties into the housing prices. It has a very important implication for how we do growth management. Ventura County, what we found is that, which has been doing very aggressive growth control and growth management, however you want to sort of define it, for over 20 years, one of the fastest growing counties in California, operates under SOAR initiative, which is save open space and agricultural areas. Resources, right. Save open space and agricultural resources. Part of that is an urban growth boundary. You need to get public approval for changing rezonings. But what we found is that in Ventura County, you see a housing shortage emerging. And to the tune of 60,000, they need 60,000 units by 2020. And at their current trends, which, by the way, there's no indication there's going to be any change, by 20, there'll be about between about 40,000 will probably be built between then and now. And this is where we get to this graph over here on the right. If you look at the general plan and you look at the densities that are actually allowed under the general plan, which is very important in California because it's binding. Typically in Midwest, in Ohio and Michigan, the zoning code is really what's binding. Comprehensive plan may or may not. But in California, the plan is. They're only approving housing at 54% of the planned densities. Now, if what you've done is you've sort of assumed that you're going to get more density because you've got growth management and you're somehow going to use this to encourage density, in Ventura County, that clearly is not happening. In fact, what you're finding is that every time a mixed-use dense project is being proposed, there's an awful lot of local resistance to it, and they end up approving it. This is not unique to Ventura County. Same thing's happening in Portland, Oregon. In fact, there's an interesting debate in the professional planning literature now about sort of what's been happening in Portland, Oregon in terms of urban design. And while they have been getting the higher density because the growth boundary has essentially forced more units to be built inside, and they're getting more apartments, and they're getting more multifamily, which is one of the goals, it's not clear at all that it's been at the density that they need to achieve, and for that matter, they have not gotten the urban design that they wanted that's not quote-unquote quality growth, however that might be defined. So what is this telling me as an analyst? One is that we need to be very careful. By the way, in each one of these states, housing affordability is a key goal of the statewide growth management law. So how is it that we have, as a key goal of the statewide growth management law, housing affordability and keeping prices in line, yet we're seeing growth management seeming to have some empirical, at least empirically, some impact on making housing affordability worse. And in fact, in Florida, we estimate that without the growth management law, we would have seen Florida become more affordable on a lot of different ranges. And it's actually reversed trends toward affordability away from it. So what is this telling us? What does it tell me? And then use this as a segue into where I think we need to go. Well, a couple things is, what do we know about the effects of statewide growth management laws? The reality is not much. This has not been a lot of analysis. Many supporters and opponents, I would argue, are partisan. They have specific interests that they are trying to promote. There's very little academic research. In fact, that's why the National Center on Smart Growth was created at the University of Maryland, which is headed by an academic named Garrett Knapp, who has done some of what I think is the pioneering and the best work on growth management in Oregon, and very academic, very respectable stuff. And most of these programs end up being created out of a sense or a commitment to the hope of what they can achieve, as opposed to a real hard-nosed analysis of what the results are. And personally, I've been struck by how willingly many of these commissions are willing to ignore some of the research that might be relevant, particularly in the areas of housing affordability and housing prices. Also important to keep in mind, most programs are ongoing experiments. I still will not pass a final judgment on Oregon because there are still a lot of things they're working out. Portland, Oregon is a good example, simply because while they've had their urban growth boundary in place since 1979, Portland just didn't grow for about a decade. As a result, the growth boundary was not significantly tested in terms of housing affordability. So I think there's a lot of evidence, and I'm convinced that the growth boundary has putting upward pressure on housing prices. I'm still willing to recognize that there still needs to be more work done on that. But the thing here is to remember that even Michigan, after several decades of other states experimenting, there's still an awful lot we don't know. So if anyone comes up and says, we know for a fact that if we have statewide growth management, we're going to have better coordinated planning, my gut instinct after looking at this is to say, maybe, maybe not. I mean, I'm not willing to go that far on it. And also, what I think I can say is none of these programs have yet been able to figure out how to repeal the laws of economics and politics. In fact, one of my biggest criticisms of the way statewide growth management is currently being devised and implemented in many of these states is they don't recognize the political nature of planning and land use. And just taking it to the state level doesn't get rid of it. It just changes the focus of interest group politics in many ways. And that's a fundamental reality that I'd like to see discussed and vetted more when we're discussing these kinds of issues. What are some of the practical pitfalls of growth management? One is, now maybe Michigan may be different going through your land use commission, but I have yet to find a consensus definition on what smart growth is. That's not to say we don't all have different definitions of smart growth. There are. Matter of fact, the US EPA has one, and they're very good at promoting it. But what came home to me as I started doing this work and really going to communities and talking to people about smart growth and land use planning is that as much as I might have a definition that works for me, it usually is not the one that is on the ground in informing policy wherever I'm visiting. And that creates a problem because it's not clear that when somebody says smart growth and you're talking to your neighbor at your table about smart growth, you're talking about the same thing. And in fact, I ran into this specifically in Michigan when I was we're talking about urban sprawl, and I was talking to an editorial board of an urban newspaper, and I suddenly realized that my definition of sprawl was different from their definition of sprawl, which meant that coming up with the right policy is very difficult unless you're talking about the same thing. You do see, I think, advocates tending toward more prescriptive tendencies. Now, if you don't like sprawl, what do you want? You want more density, you want more mixed use, you want less automobiles. But there's very little discussion, from what I can see, of the trade-offs that are involved. And ultimately, all growth management is going to be local, one way, especially in a state like Michigan. I'll get back to that in a minute. Fundamentally, smart growth is a political movement. It is not consumer-driven. My background, by the way, is also economics. That's another reason why I'm very consumer-oriented in this. There's a tendency for these programs to respond to no-growth sentiments. So you may have this vision, and this is clearly evident in Oregon, but we also see it in Washington State and Florida and Ventura County. You may create a growth management plan with the intention of accommodating future growth. The reality is the system will respond to the local politics, which is focusing on the people that are in the public hearing, which are usually residents. And frankly, working in a state as a planning board member, which has very strong local control, townships, basically we can map Ohio onto Michigan in terms of its governance. I see this all the time. And I've yet to see any recommendations that really fundamentally change that. Policy choices and market trends tend to be oversimplified. One of my favorites is that if we just get people to live near a bus stop, they'll use transit. Not going to work. I mean, good example of this, I mean, first of all, the data shows that that's not going to happen. But beyond that, I think one of the things we need to recognize, and this is part of the nuance and complexity, is that, and this is what I find when I run into polls about, you know, what if you like density or don't you like density, would you think the state should be focusing more on open space? If you called me I was answering that poll as an individual. He asked me if I like to be in a higher density. I live on a half acre. We have a half acre zoning overlay in our community, and it's been there for ever since our comprehensive plan was created in 1974 or 75. We live on a half acre tract lot. It's quintessential sprawl. But if you ask me, if someone called me and asked me, are you happy about the design of your lot and where you are, I would say no. I would say, actually, no, I'm not. I hate doing yard work. That's just not my thing. I'm not quite as happy in a dense urban living environment, but I could easily see myself in a condominium. I actually could do sort of more different kinds of things. But the problem is this. One is I got married. And when I got married, it's not just my choice that factors into this. It's my wife's choice. And you know what? My wife is really happy with that half-acre lot. She would like a little more. So if I'd say, well, gee, Susan, what do you think about moving to this condo? She'd say, well, what am I going to do about my garden? What are we going to do about the play set for the kids? So that's the other thing. I had kids. That changed my calculus. So these issues where we locate change by individual circumstance. They change by time and where the period we are in our life, both professionally and personally. And almost always, these kinds of complexities cannot be handled in a public review process about land use. You can't calibrate to that level of sophistication. Yet very often, many of these programs are put in place with the assumption that we can make kinds of decisions. The other problem I run into, is that it's a closed system. Again, you're sort of sitting there making decisions based on the information that's in front of you, but the reality, and this is also true in high density, specifically with mass transit, but the reality is that these systems are not necessarily consistent with what future residents may want. In fact, in my community, we have gone from when I grew up, I'm living two streets away from where I grew up, we were a community of about 1,200 people, now 10,000. We were isolated at 1,200 and agricultural. We are now in the middle of about 100, a suburban community of about 100,000. So we're 10,000 amidst about 100,000 in the particular metro area where I am. Very different needs, very different values. And the idea of 1975, identifying a comprehensive plan that somehow map how that community changes and identifying some sort of vision, frankly, is hard for me to swallow. Because I just, as a practical matter, won't be happening. Another reality is regulation is always easier than deregulation. This is a pitfall because if you choose to go the easy route to regulate, you can't count on being able to reverse that decision. It's actually easy to deregulate and then re-regulate as a practical matter. But once you regulate, very often you are at a practical point of no return. You almost need a revolution in political thinking on the local level to shift that. And ultimately, the thing that bothers me the most is diversity and innovation become difficult under conventional development regulation. What do I mean by that? I used to think that when someone would come into our community, and we've been approving hundreds of housing unit permits as part of our rezoning because of our growth, I used to think that when someone would come up and say, we're really concerned about the loss of open space with a subdivision, that they were actually concerned about the loss of open space. Or when they came and they were arguing against that condo development that was being proposed in our formerly agricultural but now becoming much more urban type of community, they said, boy, what's going to happen to the traffic? I thought they were really concerned about the traffic. What I've discovered, and I'm seeing this over and over again, is that what they're really concerned about is their community is changing. And they're afraid of change. And the problem with this is that our communities are, this is really the meat of where I think we need to rethink how we do growth management, is to recognize that communities are open-ended, they are dynamic, and they evolve. And the problem that I'm finding is that there's an inconsistency with our conventional planning, which sort of starts out with this vision process, then sort of implicitly takes this comprehensive plan, tries to take a zoning code that maps into the comprehensive plan. And if you go as far as California has and say you actually need public approval before you make a change to that zoning plan, you are essentially trying to lock a community into a particular kind of growth over a 20, 30, or 40-year period. And as a practical matter, well, first of all, I don't think it's a good idea anyway, because I think you can't freeze your community in that way. It doesn't happen. And there are certain fundamental parts to the way we govern our communities in Michigan and Ohio in particular, but also in this broader country we call the United States, that are going to limit our ability, create to lock that kind of vision in. Diversity and innovation are crucial to keeping our communities evolving, and we need to, and that needs to be a part of our planning process and our growth. I mean, literally, I do take growth management for being the management of growth, not as a sort of a pseudo way to growth control. But the politics of the way we do planning is, in fact, to convert growth management into growth control, because that's the logic of the politics of dealing with growth on the local level. And the question is, can we break this? Well, first of all, we need to sort of recognize a couple things. And again, what I like about Michigan is it maps so well onto Ohio. And I've worked as a consultant with townships as well as municipalities. So I've dealt with these sort of rural urban conflicts and certainly experienced them in my community. We need to recognize that there's a culture of local control, strong townships, strong emphasis on local government responsibilities, implicit recognition of diversity as part of that. In other words, we're recognizing that the reason we have local control is because communities have different identities, and those identities may evolve, but they're different from the township next door or the city next door. We have a fragmented government structure as a result. We are politically and culturally diverse. Just get on a road in downtown Detroit and go across the state west, and you can see that diversity. Actually, that's something I used to do all the time when I'd go into a new city, find a major thoroughfare and just drive. And the diversity within cities is amazing. Once you go between cities, it even becomes more amazing. And then do it north in Michigan, you can see it pretty easily. Also, though, in Michigan, and I think this is something that we just have to recognize, Michigan is a very low-density state. I mean, I am surprised, coming from Ohio, where the development patterns aren't that much different, but there's a lot of low density here. And when you talk about going to a higher density in Michigan, on the margin, in other words, that incremental step, it's probably not going to be a huge step. We're not talking going to Portland-style densities here. Portland-style density, I would argue, are politically and economically unachievable in this environment in Michigan. By the way, average lot size in Portland, Oregon now is 8,000 square feet. An acre is 44,000 square feet. Half acre, which I live on, is 22,000 square feet. You cannot legally buy a lot bigger than 9,000 square feet in Portland. What people are doing is they're buying a vacant lot next to their house. They're just not developing that as a lot. Again, very aggressive, very strict kind of growth control. By the way, and that low density also means that there's a lot of that. Your transportation mobility is automobile-based. That is not to say there is not a role for transit. I mean, we need to make that very clear, because I usually get pegged as being anti-transit. I think there is a role for transit. It does have implications for how you do transit. And also it requires you to be more realistic about what you can expect out of transit in terms of not only impacting land use, but also enhancing mobility. But it is not necessarily anti-transit. All right, where do I go from looking at this? I see all these holes in the statewide growth management laws. But, you know, it's interesting if you look at how they've been talking about these issues over the last 5 years. They've become less and less hierarchical and less centrally planning directed in terms of their rhetoric. And that's in large part because they're recognizing Minneapolis-St. Paul cannot be translated very easily into Michigan. Portland, Oregon is not going to happen in the Detroit area. Because we have a very different culture. All right, so is there a way out of this? Because there are real issues. There are issues of traffic congestion. There are issues of whether or not we are providing the right infrastructure at the right time for development. Is there a way out of this? Well, as a practical way, I think there is. But I think we have to think differently about how we do the growth management. This is true on the local level, but it's also true on the state level. And here's where the opportunity is. One is to focus on performance. Focus less. What I mean by that is make sure your tools and your implementation are linked together. Don't set a goal that is unachievable simply because the politics doesn't work or, for that matter, the pattern's already set. If you're already a low-density pattern, don't say you're going to recreate Miami, city of Miami, which is very high-density, or Los Angeles, which is very high-density. In Detroit or Grand Rapids or wherever, that is very unlikely that's going to happen. The implementation has to recognize that. Local control, but at the other end, talk about having statewide goals that are somehow going to be imposed on the planning process, where you have to have conformity and consistency among those levels. You need to make sure that those are congruent. Problem-specific remedies. If you're concerned about transportation, look at transportation. One of the things that I found interesting as I was getting into this issue was the sort of this transportation land use link, which actually 8 years ago I thought there was a lot of content to it. Then when I started getting into that specific, I realized that there wasn't. That actually what happened, and we just did a study at Buckeye on the impact of major road improvements on growth patterns. And what we found is that major road improvements have very little impact on actual growth patterns. What ends up happening is you're accommodating the existing pattern of growth with those investments. And 70% of our growth occurred in census tracts that had no major road improvements at all. So now it's not saying we didn't find any. We found a couple. I think we found two interstate connections, right, interstate ramps that were developed in the 90s that seemed to have an impact. But the impact was to create traffic equivalent to a fast food restaurant. So the basic patterns were largely already set. Now, of course, that'll change depending on where you are. But if you focus on a performance, I think we begin to deal with specific issues. Resist the tendency to identify a silver bullet. And this is, again, I'm going to pick a little bit on new urbanists at this point, not because I'm unsympathetic. Actually, I'm on the new urbanist listserv on the Internet precisely because I am very sympathetic to a lot of new urbanist design. New urbanism is mixed use, higher density, typically but not always more transit-oriented, but the idea is to sort of remodel our cities based on the old town center, rural area. And it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. But the problem is that, in particularly an area like Michigan, that is a choice. And maybe it's a choice that's not allowed right now by our zoning codes. But the chances of that particular type of land use pattern serving the broad needs of housing and consumer choice in Michigan are probably pretty slim. So the problem, I think, is we need to recognize that the housing market is dynamic. You know, I lived, you know, in an urban atmosphere when I was young, got married, choices changed, had children, other things entered the calculus, like quality schools and that kind of stuff. Diversity evolves. Our community was fine as a rural community, but now it is much more diverse than it ever was before. We have strong demand for higher density condominium townhouse type developments, and communities are open-ended. Again, getting away from this notion that somehow we can identify a specific vision that can be achieved, that it has some real concrete limits to it. Recognize the limits of public policy. Probably the biggest shortfall I see in the way growth management is done as a practical matter. What I mean by this, we need to recognize that property rights are here to stay. You can't just sort of tell people what they're going to do with their property. That's not to say that regulation isn't going to be used. It will. But don't operate as if either property rights or markets don't exist, because they do exist. And my experience has been that markets will always trump centralized planning. Even it will do that. It's even doing it in Oregon. Rather than finding the house on the big lot in Portland, people are now commuting 45 minutes and 50 minutes from smaller communities outside the growth boundary to develop, and they're doing it there. And ultimately, in an area like Ohio or Michigan, what you have is you can always go someplace else. I mean, you can go across the border to Indiana, you can go across the border to Ohio. In fact, we're experiencing our folks moving north to Michigan, which is an issue, but that probably will not be resolved until somehow Ohio State and the University of Michigan become buddies at some point. Highly unlikely. For that, ultimately, particularly in states like Ohio and Michigan, markets will almost always trump centralized planning. And as part of our culture in these states, what this means is that individual choice is fundamental to our housing culture. Now, what I could do, I've gone on way longer than I intended to. So what I think I ought to do is conclude with a final slide and then open up to questions, simply because I like questions more than I do listening to me talk. Although you probably don't believe that now. But anyway, what does this mean in a practical way? And by the way, if anyone wants a copy of this, of my presentation, just give me your card, let me know, or let Diane Katz of the Mackinac Center know, and we'll get a copy to you as soon as possible. I think you do need to focus on incentives, not mandates. I think part of this is preserving choice. I think that means you need to build a presumption favoring markets. Markets are going to best. I mean, the best. You want to know what people want to live? Talk to a builder or talk to a developer, because their mortgage, paying their mortgage, putting food on the table, depends on their ability to meet that. And frankly, I know a lot more developers and builders who have gone out of business because they didn't guess the market than I know planners that lost their job because they didn't guess the market. Get prices right. In other words, I think there's a lot to that. Public services, to the extent you can price them the right way, it makes sense. You know, try to avoid subsidies, cross-subsidization between one group and another. Minimize micromanagement and politics. This is Florida. I think that's going to really killing the Florida system. The Florida Department of Community Affairs literally micromanages the kinds of plans that localities can put into place, and it's creating a huge gulf between what the market wants and what the state wants. They've had to make some changes, but it's created a lot of problems as a result. And focus your planning on spillover impacts. Long-range infrastructure planning, data is important. What this is really saying is that we need to focus on tools that the local community can have to sort of embed this kind of diversity in embracing this dynamic part of the housing market. But it also means that the planning doesn't become the detailed master planning of figuring out whether you're going to put an apartment building on this block or a single-family house in this block. It becomes more strategic in its focus. In other words, if you believe that the local government is going to provide roads, what you need to do is be clear about what that transportation network is going to look like. But don't worry so much about the densities that might emerge, because those densities and those uses are going to evolve over a period of 20 or 30 years, and you can't really tell at this point what that's going to be. All right, so the bottom line is I'm talking about is moving toward a more strategic approach to growth management, moving away from detailed visions, and ultimately focusing on real issues that people identify with: traffic congestion, open space. Those are specific things, but also put that in a market context. Final thing I would say: recognize trade-offs. If you're going to develop a hierarchical Florida-type growth management system, recognize you're giving up local control. You're giving up a fundamental part of the representative government on the local level that has been part of that planning. And if you ignore those trade-offs, it's going to create problems down the road. Because these are contradictions that will have to be resolved at some point. So being realistic is an important part of that as well.